What are the next level of malicious activities and examples that come to mind?
So there's some scary ones. And in the end, over $750,000 worth of assets were stolen. I spoke to some other people. Yeah, it's the same scammers in Rome that robbed the Webiverse team. And she could have lost tens of thousands of dollars. So they stole crazy amounts of crypto. It's worth like $5 billion, I think, at one point, with kind of price appreciations. This is the really kind of almost like fun, interesting fight that we have with the criminals. Is they're trying to figure out what they can do to evade our software. Kind of keys to the kingdom, so all the private keys for the funds were found in a popcorn tin under a floorboard. Like, it's classic kind of criminal 101, like, you just don't bury your treasure under the floorboards, do you?
All right, I am excited for this chat, partly because we have been trying to do it for the best part of almost a year. But I met Tara at an NFT event a little while ago, and we were chatting in the pub, and it was one of the most mad and interesting conversations I've had for a long time, all about crime in the metaverse and wider kind of crypto world, and what Tara does to kind of track it. In my mind, this isn't probably an accurate description of your job. You're kind of like a crypto detective. So, it was an awesome conversation, and we've been meaning to do it. So, Tara, thank you very much. And welcome on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to chat all things metaverse crime.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be fun. Okay, should we start by, maybe you could just tell people about your role and what you do at Elliptic, which is the company you've been working at, what they do. Just give it all a bit of context before we kind of dive into the mad stories.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm head of technical crypto advisory at Elliptic, a bit of a fancy sounding title. I'm basically our chief nerd there. Been in this space now about 8 years. So in crypto sense, that's a long time, a lot of different markets, a lot of different crimes. And Elliptic is very much at the forefront of the anti-crime kind of space in crypto. So we basically detect and try and prevent crypto crime, working with exchanges, merchant service payment providers, crypto businesses, even TradFi's. They basically use our software to be able to say who is involved in this transaction. So if you are, let's say, sending some money from Coinbase, an exchange, and you think you're sending it to a really exciting new project, but actually we've done a load of research and we know they're a scammer, then we can alert Coinbase, and then they can say, hang on, I don't think you want to make that payment. You're about to get scammed. So kind of like the kind of crypto on-chain detectives, police, trying to make sure that it's a bit of a safer space. And if you're a bad actor, you can't use crypto for all sorts of illicit purposes.
Yeah, so interesting. That is an important service for sure. So yeah, where should we start? Where do you think it's good to kind of give people a framework of what's going on? And you talked about lots of cool stuff that you do there. What are some examples of some of the things that you've kind of found in the first instance and then gone, actually, do you know what? We need to flag this and stop people kind of getting hurt or going down the wrong path.
Yeah, so there's no shortage of examples, that's for sure. We write an enormous amount of content on all of the various different crime typologies that we see. And in the metaverse space specifically, you've got everything from your kind of bog standard, slightly basic crimes to some of the more exotic ones where criminals are thinking much more creatively. So if you take, for instance, Decentraland or Sandbox, two of the most well-known virtual worlds, you are going to come across really vanilla crimes like domain squatting. So a little while ago, Google actually banned ads for Decentraland, like paid ads, because there was a huge problem with people buying like Decentraland.net and Decentraland with two D's, say, .com, all with the idea that if they're the
classic.
Kind of...
Yeah, it's
absolutely classic scam, yeah. Exactly. So really, like, it's not... You know, your criminals aren't thinking outside the box here. They're just trying to get you to click on that sponsored link at the top, thinking that you're going in. Now, of course, that's super dangerous, because when you go into a virtual world, in most cases, they say, you know, connect your MetaMask and come in and have a persistent ID. Well, if you tried to connect your MetaMask, what they would be doing is they would ping up your like a little MetaMask box that says, you know, sites like approval transaction. You think, oh, I'm just logging in. Nope, they're going to absolutely wipe your wallet and clear of all of your assets, fungibles, non-fungibles, everything. So that's like one example where criminals are kind of looking at the Web2 space and crimes there, and then just porting it across to try and essentially like trip up users who are maybe new to it, kind of still finding their feet in the metaverse.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's important, isn't it? Because that is, although it sounds simple, it will catch people out. And I've seen it with sponsored links as well, where I've got close to, like, especially because they're sponsored, you kind of inherently trust them, and which isn't good. When you do go on a fake website and that MetaMask box pops up, very like briefly, how are they draining your wallet? You're basically giving over approvals. You're signing something that says, yeah, you know, you have access to everything, and then they can pull it from your wallet. Is that what's happening in that most simple case?
Exactly. So there's a couple of different ways that they try and exploit this, but one of the simplest ones is just by using a function. So they're kind of will pop up with a message, and there'll be a long string of like numbers and letters. You kind of look at it and you're like, oh, I don't know what that's doing, but it's probably fine. Spoiler, it's probably not. So there's like a function called set approval for all, which allows, if you kind of grant that permission to someone else, you're basically saying, have full control, do whatever you want with my account. So it's kind of an account takeover is the best way to think about it. And it just allows the hackers to do whatever they want with all of your assets. So that's like a sneaky way that they'll try and get in, based on the fact that most people, when they see MetaMask pop up, like you don't read through all the metadata. You probably don't understand what most of the metadata is doing. So by them trying to kind of lull you into a false sense of security that you're on the official like page for Decentraland, you kind of think, oh, well, I'm sure it's fine. That's just like a MetaMask message.
Got you. Okay, that's well explained, yeah. And that's good to be aware of. And probably good practice, something that I do is have like a wallet where you don't keep much in if you're going to something new that you're not sure about. And then worst case scenario, if they did have access to that, well, they don't pull or anything valuable really from it. So is that kind of what you'd make yeah. say to people?
Yeah, definitely. And always say, you know, check, double check the domains as well. Like this is one that, and I suppose this is topical with the Azuki drama recently. So a couple of months back, they had an account takeover on Twitter. So it was their gold ticked account on Twitter. So, you know, things that you think should be safe sometimes aren't, which is why you have to like check and double check, whether it's the URL, whether it's an account, like check on Discord, double check on Twitter, double check on like whatever platforms they're on. But what happened there was the Azuki account tweeted out saying that their new metaverse had launched. So Azuki's been talking about for ages now, they're going to have a metaverse. I think it's called Hulumia. And everyone was kind of waiting and thinking like, when are they going to drop it? And of course, in crypto, we get a lot of surprise announcements. That's not really, you know, something in and of itself, which is a red flag. But their account tweeted and said, hey, Azuki .ws, which is a bit of a weird domain, but they were like, this is the new metaverse we're launching, go in and claim your land. And the website was super profesh, like it looked genuinely like Azuki. And you went on there and then it said, claim your free land, click here, up pops, you know, your MetaMask box. And again, it's one of these dangerous functions. And so all of these really excited people were thinking like, oh my gosh, I've got the first announcement of it. I'm going to mint this land. How exciting. And in the end, over $750,000 worth of assets were stolen, primarily USDC from one user. They were hit really hard, but there was 18 NFTs stolen, including Azuki and Beans and a load of like hip hop imagery, which was kind of random. But yeah, the attackers ran away with all of that in just 2 hours. They managed to steal all of that, all from compromising the official Twitter account.
How do you think they maybe got control of that gold ticked account? You'd think that Azuki would have a regular two-factor authentication where you have to have the app in your presence, where you can't just guess their password and get in, would be my first question. And then the second one is when someone has created that fake website, they've set up the MetaMask malicious kind of function and they've done the attack, how do you do they generally get away with it still? Or that's probably a whole nother world we'll go into, but how do you start the process of maybe catching them? Do they get prosecuted and all of those things? So maybe we start with Twitter and then
yeah.
we move on to that.
So yeah. One of the challenges for projects is that they're often run by numerous people. So you need to be able to easily share credentials. You've maybe got like a small team or even a big team running the social media. So having two-factor authentication, sometimes people think, oh, it's a bit of a pain. We want to just make it simple. So whilst absolutely you should have 2FA, a lot of projects just don't, and they leave themselves open. There's also a lot, and I do a lot of monitoring of what's happening on the dark web in terms of like services for sale. There's a lot of tech and services available for compromising Discords, for instance. That's like a big thing at the moment. Just a lot of social engineering. So there'll be, you'll get an email in your inbox saying, oh, you have, and I get these all the time, you've got like 2000 Ether that is unclaimed on this account. Click here to access it. And you're like, no, I'm not clicking there. That's definitely fake. But there's a lot of really clever phishing that they set up to try and compromise these accounts, as well as technology to try and kind of get in front essentially of 2FA. So if you do 2FA via an SMS, for instance, there's something called SIM swapping, where you can essentially basically ring up the carrier, pretend that you need to swap the SIM if your phone was stolen or something like that. And sadly, it works quite well that you're able to dupe them. So never use SMS for a 2FA, always try and use like a Google Auth or something. That's typically more secure. But actually, in many cases, it's like bad security practice, lax security practice, rather than anything, you know, Mission Impossible style clever getting in. And then the challenge is, once they're in, if you're on the official admin account on Discord or gold ticked account on Twitter, for followers, they see that naturally as a stamp of approval. So once you're in, you've got kind of all sorts of access you can do. And we saw that back in, I think it was the kind of great Twitter hack of August 2020, when you had everyone from like Kim Kardashian, Barack Obama, Bill Gates, all of their, at the time when it was Blue Twig, they were taken over. They tweeted what's called a giveaway scam. So they said, hey, I'm feeling generous, send some Bitcoin to this address and I'll send you double back. Spoiler, you didn't get anything back.
Barack Obama's always doing that. Yeah.
He's not doing that. But because it was coming from their official accounts, people thought, well, this feels a bit odd, but it must be official. It's Barack Obama's blue ticked account. And so that's what a lot of criminals are doing. They're trying to kind of ride on the coattails of like legitimacy by getting into these kind of accounts and then trying to dupe kind of fans and community members that way.
Interesting. Very quickly, before we move on to the MetaMask Azuki stuff, I also watched a video on YouTube of someone really cleverly who had recorded like some audio from another video, and it was a mother who was with a baby, and the baby was screaming, and they basically, I think, paid someone to kind of ring up the mobile phone carrier, the network you're on, playing this kind of audio in the background as if it was like a very stressful situation. And they'd sort of half forgotten the password, and the person on the other end of the phone who worked for the network provider eventually just gave in the password because they thought they were really stressed and needed to sort something. And then I guess that's where the SIM swapping happened. So I'm sure there's, you know, practices in place to stop that. But it was interesting to watch because you could see how that kind of thing does happen. But yeah,
definitely. And I think like the second part of what you're asking in terms of like catching the criminals, that's actually tracking the criminals is easy. The blockchain is fantastic for tracking. Catching them is really, really hard. So if you take the Azuki hackers, for instance, they basically got away with it. No one's gone to prison. No one's been arrested. They moved pretty much all of the money. So the NFTs were all liquidated. That is like par for the course. So it was about 5,000, it was 4,600 worth of NFTs. They all went to SudoSwap and X2Y2. So we could kind of see those move really easily, got liquidated.
And those are other marketplaces that maybe, would they not get marked as stolen initially? So somebody would have bought those NFTs, owning them, and then maybe sometimes they get marked once.
Yeah, so it's all about speed, basically. So if you're the criminal, what you'll tend to do is you'll mark them either lower than the kind of current rate, or maybe you'll even go to like below floor just to try and get them off the books. Now, you've got a lot of NFT kind of sniping bots that people have created that are just looking for a deal, essentially. They're not doing any KYC. They're not checking whether these assets have come from a hack or a scam. So they just see a deal, they'll kind of sweep them up, might sell them on. If you are, you know, your average person, again, looking for a deal, maybe you've been hoping to buy an Azuki for ages and suddenly you see one that's come on, you buy it, and then it turns out it's come from a scammer. Do you give it back to the person that was scammed? Like, is it kind of black marked forever? Like, it's a bit of a challenging one because the person could have bought it without knowing at all it was part of a crime. So that's certainly a bit of a challenge. And whilst you've got marketplaces like OpenSea who have done a good job of marking assets saying, you know, warning, this has come from a compromise or a scam, the challenge is, like, most often the criminals have managed to liquidate it before they can even get that tag on there. So it's already in someone else's ownership and they've already got the money for it. They've kind of cut and run. For the fungible asset, so that was a whole load. There was, I think, 0.2 WEF. There's a whole bunch of STAHL, which stayed in the connected accounts, but mainly USDC. Now, USDC is an interesting one to steal because it's a stable coin, firstly. So feels like an ideal one to steal. You don't have the volatility. But as with USDT, you can freeze the funds in someone's account. So that's a function of the ERC20 token. So if you're Circle, the issuer, or Tether for USDT, if someone commits a crime with your funds, you can literally like hold it, pin it into that account and say you can't move it any further, which means if you're a criminal and you get hold of a load of Tether or USDC, you need to get rid of it essentially really quickly before those companies act and freeze your funds. And that's exactly what we saw with the USDC. So the criminal moved the funds really quickly into a consolidation account. They actually then brought in around about 745, I think, thousand pounds from Uniswap. So potentially they've done some other pretty dodgy stuff elsewhere. And then what they did from there is they moved it into your two kind of classic places for a scammer. About half a million went to Tornado Cash, and then around about 750,000 went to Uniswap. Now, Tornado Cash back in August, so the 8th of August last year, was actually sanctioned by the US Foreign Asset Controls. So it is a sanctioned entity in and of itself. So actually, this criminal has both like stolen stuff, which is illegal, but they've interacted with a sanctioned actor. So they actually now have an international sanctions violation, which is pretty bad by all accounts as well. But it was a way they could essentially obscure the flow of funds. They've run off now with that half a million. And from a Uniswap perspective, and I wrote about this fairly recently, DEXs are a really fantastic place to try and hide funds. If you're a criminal, you're basically using it as a pool of money that you can wash funds through, swap it to a different asset, swap it through a whole bunch of different pools, and then run away with some effectively clean money. So it was unsurprising. That's kind of what they did. Liquidate the NFTs to get it into kind of fungibles, get out of any USDT or USDC, which can be frozen, put it through a mixer, put it through a DEX to try and obscure the flow of funds. And then essentially you're away clean, like perfect crime done, sadly.
Crazy. That is so fascinating. We should say you write so much amazing content as well. So we'll leave all the links below. Definitely go and follow Tara on all this stuff. But could you, for anyone who's a bit newer, just explain like Tornado Cash, what a mixer is, kind of maybe how it works briefly. And also when you're sort of washing funds or when that happens, what's the sort of basic premise there? How do they get rid of this kind of trace of stuff and eventually get away with it? And does that money have to stay in the crypto system? Because I assume there's no way of getting it out into traditional fiat currency, pounds or dollars, without some kind of KYC, i.e. identifying yourself to then go and spend it in the physical world.
Yeah, so a mixer is basically it's called a mixer, tumbler. There's been all sorts of names over kind of crypto's history. But essentially what it is a service which allows you to mix your money with other people. So let's say I've got 100 Ether and it's connected to a crime. So it's like dirty, kind of bad money. Maybe you've got 100 Ether, which is, you know, you got for your birthday. Perfectly lovely, clean Ether, no crimes attached. Now, obviously, my Ether has this illicit trail. If I go to someone and say, I want to deposit this into your exchange or buy something with this, then they can see it's bad money. They don't want to touch it. So what a mixer allows you to do is kind of we all pool our money together and then it kind of mixes it up. And then I can take out 100 Ether. You can take out 100 Ether, but it comes out of this collective pot. So there's no longer clean and dirty money. You kind of have this like tainted pot. But when I take my money out, you don't know whose money I'm taking out. There's no connection to my 100 that I initially put in and now the 100 I'm taking out. So all you know is you've got a load of people putting money in, a load of people taking money out, and you can't connect the depositors and the withdrawers, because what you do in Tornado Cash and others is you have fixed sums. So you can put in 100 Ether, 10 Ether, 1 Ether, 0.1 Ether, which means that all deposits just like look like chunks coming in, chunks coming out. It's not like I'm putting in 7 and taking out 7. And you can say, oh, well, no one else has put in 7 and taken out 7, so they must be the same person. Instead, there's like 1,000 people that have all put in 1 Ether, 1,000 people that have taken them out. And you're like, well, is that the same person as that? I can't tell. And so that's what it creates, is this obscurity between depositors and withdrawers by mixing the money. And so you can't tell who's put it in, who's taken it out. Now, the obvious question a lot of people ask at this point is like, well, if you had clean money, why would you put it in? And it's a really good question. If you look at Tornado Cash, it processed around about $7.6 billion worth of funds. And at least 1.5 billion of that was connected to the Lazarus Group, which is North Korea's hacking group. So pretty dirty pot of connections, going towards all sorts of awful things in North Korea. And so many people said, well, why would anyone use Tornado Cash if it's got dirty money in that's being linked to, you know, really bad activity? And the challenge is that there's also many legitimate uses for mixers, because privacy is normal. Privacy, financial privacy is totally okay. You know, you had people like Vitalik Buterin, so Ethereum co-founder. He said, listen, I've used Tornado Cash because he was donating to pro-Ukraine groups. He's obviously got Russian heritage. He wanted to kind of keep that a little bit on the DL. So he wanted to use a mixer. You've got some people like celebrities who use mixers because they don't want fans or the wider community seeing what like NFTs they're going to be buying with money. They don't want anyone to be influenced by what they're doing in case they make a bad trade, or they just don't want people seeing what they're doing. If you're paid crypto as a salary, maybe you want to use a mixer so all the employees can't see exactly who's being paid what or who's spending what. So there's all sorts of legitimate uses for a mixer. The challenge is there's also loads of really bad, dodgy uses for a mixer. And so you get this kind of clean and dirty money all intermingled, and then you can't tell who's putting it in, who's taking out. And that's what criminals exploit, the fact that they can use those mixers to hide their illicit activity.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Yeah, that's so well explained, because those are the questions that I had, and I know a lot of other people will have as well. So yeah, it's fascinating to learn both the good and bad use cases, and all of this is happening in real time. We'll talk maybe later about the kind of percentage of crypto that is used for illicit activities, because when we talk about crime, it sounds like it all is, but actually it's a small percentage, as we'll talk about. Before we get there, the other question that I was talking about, was so that hacker with the Azuki hack that we've talked about has done that, then gone through the mixer and now has these sort of clean funds, in inverted commas. What happens next, and can they ever get that out into physical money again, or what's kind of the final portion of their sort of journey, and essentially they've got away with it, it sounds like?
Yeah, so the kind of main thing you're trying to do if you're a criminal is eventually get to what we call fiat currency, so dollars, pounds, because that's really what you need in the real world. It's like if you are, you know, let's think of something awful, you're like a weapons trader, you're probably not going to be able to go up and be like, hey, I've got some USDC, will you accept this for a missile? Like, the world runs in illicit activity still on cash and dollars, essentially. So if you're a criminal, you've got away with all this USDC, or you've traded it then for some ether, you've washed it through Tornado Cash, and then you're kind of sat there like, right, how do I get this into dollars? Now, you've got a couple of options, but the one you're probably going to try and use straight away is an exchange. And there's a lot of exchanges out there that have fantastic know your customer, so KYC policies. They're using crypto compliance tools like Elliptic, for instance, and you can't use them, because the moment you try and deposit funds in, for instance, our software pings up and says that's coming from Tornado Cash. Just be careful. So those kind of exchanges will just say, listen, absolutely no, we're not dealing with you. However, there's a lot of exchanges out there who either have slightly relaxed policies when it comes to doing crypto compliance, and there's actually some exchanges out there who were set up entirely to fund criminal enterprises. Now, that seems pretty crazy, but BTCE, for instance, a very famous exchange, which was based in Russia, was fully set up to launder the proceeds from a really big hack that happened back in 2013, 2014, the Silk Road hack. Someone literally created an exchange, connected it to, in that case, the Russian banking system, to launder money through it. And there's other examples as well where you can see the proportion of funds coming into the exchanges are incredibly high from an illicit perspective. Dark market funds coming in, sanctions related funds, child sexual abuse related funds coming in, like the worst of the worst things. And the exchange is allowing it because that's what it was set up to do, is process that dirty money. You can do that taking a pretty big cut, because those kind of criminal actors are willing to pay to get their money into the banking system. So that is the challenge, that you can get it out to fiat, because there's exchanges that don't keep their kind of financial crime policies as good as they should. And so the criminals find those little holes, and then whole categories of exchanges that are literally set up to process that kind of illicit activity.
that's wild, isn't it? I didn't know that was happening, and they're happening in other regions across the world where maybe their laws are different and maybe that's harder to stop as well. There's also the decentralized side of stuff, the DEXs or decentralized exchanges. So for anyone new, ones that aren't run by companies necessarily, they're set up by people, but I don't have a CEO of the company. Do they play a role in this as well, because they're kind of harder to take down and stuff? And again, so many good use cases, and privacy is important on both sides, as you talked about, but just for this thread at the moment, are they part of some of this as well?
Yeah, so often what criminals are going to do is they're trying to create a really complex web of transactions. So what they'll do is they'll move it through a number of DEXs, so decentralized exchanges, where you can swap one asset for another. So they'll maybe start with some BAT, they'll exchange that to USDC, they'll then exchange that again for STAR, then they'll put it into WETH. So they'll kind of hop from asset to asset. What they might even do is they might use a bridge and move it from Arbitrum onto Optimism. Then they might take it over to Solana. So they might drop up across all of these chains, all with the aim of when they deposit eventually into an exchange, because that's where you have your fiat off ramp. So your dollars and your pounds that you can trade your crypto to. That what they're trying to do is just create this really complicated path. They're basically trying to get around blockchain analytics. Like, this is the really kind of almost like fun, interesting fight that we have with the criminals, is they're trying to figure out what they can do to evade our software. So they're like, okay, let's change assets 10 times. Let's jump across 3 different chains. Let's put it through these mixers. Let's go across bridges, all this activity, thinking that they can essentially hide. So the best way that I talk about this is like in a police chase, where you've got the criminal running away, and maybe they'll run through a mall to try and like shake the cops off. Then they'll go jump in a car and there'll be a little car chase, and then maybe they'll go through an underground car park to try and chase them off, etc. We're like the kind of infrared helicopter that's just like looking down on them with the camera, like, oh yeah, there they are. Okay, yeah, they've just swapped into that. Oh, they're now on the motorbike. And we can just see everything that they're doing. And the criminals kind of come out the other end, you know, maybe they've changed outfit, walking casually down the street like, aha, no one knows it's us. And we're just there like, yeah, it's that guy there. We've just seen exactly what he's done. But that's like what the criminals are trying to do. They're trying to move across all chains, assets, through lots of different services, hoping that a blockchain analytics firm basically loses their tail. And when they deposit into the exchange runs a check. The check comes back and says, yeah, looks okay. So that's like the war really going on with criminals and blockchain analytics, is like trying to out-innovate each other.
Yeah, the sort of digital car chase. Yeah. It's mad, isn't it? I keep saying how interesting it is, but it is. And finally, on this point, before maybe we chat about some kind of other things that are happening, where do most criminals sort of mess up? Like, where do they get caught? And that obviously that happens, you spot them and stuff. They just is there like a common kind of reason why usually they end up getting caught?
So it's a good question. There's a couple of reasons. So one, a lot of criminals think if you just move funds from lots of different accounts, so we call it hopping basically, then you lose track. So they'll be like, oh, you start with say $1 million, you move it to the next account, and then you have pretty much $1 million minus fees, and then you move it to the next one, $1 million minus fees. And eventually after like 100 hops, they're like, well, there's no way they can possibly trace that far back. It's like super easy for our software to do. So that's a mistake they make. They think like if they just do loads of hops, like suddenly they're invisible. So that's a very easy way that they mess up. Another one I think that they mess up by is just trying to do things too quickly. So, and we've talked today already about, you know, time is of the essence with a lot of these crimes. And often they will send funds to an account which is linked with a previous crime that they've done, for instance. So that then kind of makes the link even stronger when they try and move it on. We're like, well, like that's connected now in several nexuses to the criminal. Or they'll try and move to an exchange straight away, thinking, oh, well, there's no way they can possibly catch us this quickly. All of our systems are real time. So the moment we spot a scam, we can label it. So they think, oh, well, just get to an exchange straight away. Well, you're going to be blocked. So a lot of the mistakes that they make are, for us anyway, nicely like simple ones, where like I think that's one of the challenges of being a criminal. Actually, it's quite hard to be a really good criminal. Like, even if you look at the Bitfinex hackers from way back in 2016, so they stole crazy amounts of crypto. It's worth like $5 billion, I think, at one point, with kind of price appreciations. And they just their tactic was, we're going to essentially leave the money sat there and hope everyone forgets.
Put your head in the sand tactic.
Yeah, we're watching this. Like, like, we're watching those accounts like a hawk. We've got automated monitoring, like, you know. So the moment those funds move, we're watching where they're going. And so these criminals kind of sat there dormant for ages, years and years and years. And then they started moving funds. And they started moving them basically thinking, aha, no one will be watching us. We can kind of move those. And they got caught. Two people got arrested, and essentially the kind of keys to the kingdom, so all the private keys for the funds, were found in a popcorn tin under a floorboard. Like, it's classic kind of criminal 101. Like, you just don't bury your treasure under the floorboards, do you? And so that's like how they were caught. They thought no one was watching because there'd been so many years, but this is like, it's all on a blockchain. It's immutably there forever. We can see whenever you move that, whether it's 10 minutes later, whether it's, you know, 10 days, or whether it's 10 years later, we can watch that. And then eventually they were caught because they made a you know, classic silly mistake of keeping their funds under the floorboard.
That is so wild. That's sort of hilarious in many ways, and less so because it's so much money and obviously malicious stuff. But this is probably a good time to actually talk about, if you have any context of malicious activity in the blockchain world, which, as we've talked about, is by definition or by design, is generally very traceable, but with some kind of nuances, versus the more traditional world. Because we see stories about banks that are getting fined, you know, loads of money for laundering money or being part of like a thing that they haven't acted on quick enough. And also, you know, with cash in the physical world has no traceable qualities, in the sense if you give somebody £100 in cash and nobody's looking, well, then there's absolutely no way to trace that. So do you have any context of this versus the sort of traditional world?
I think so. That's the real challenge, really, with crypto, is there's a lot of stories about crime happening, whether it's scams, it's a rug pull, it's a investment scam, you know, pick your poison. There's so many crimes happening in crypto from a typology perspective, and they hit the headlines. But there's also a lot of crimes in traditional finance that don't hit the headlines because they happen all the time. There's, you know, billions of bank fines that have been levied for all sorts of activity. And the challenge is that it's really easy to report in crypto when something goes wrong because it's all on chain. So we basically have really good stats in crypto. And that's what penalizes us, because TradFi doesn't have those stats. You know, we don't have a running total on several websites about how many financial crimes happen in the UK, for instance, or in US dollars across the globe. But we do have actual stats about DeFi exploits to, you know, to the Satoshi or to the Gwei. And I think that's kind of really challenging from a perception perspective, because it means people say, well, crypto is so much worse than TradFi. Look at how many billion dollars has been stolen already this year. And you're like, well, actually, it's probably more in traditional finance. We just don't have the stats. And it's the same kind of thing, actually, when you look at the treatment and the kind of talking around the environmental impact of crypto as well. We know how much energy crypto uses. Like, we can put real metrics on it. We don't know what's used from an environmental perspective in the whole finance industry, for instance. So that's a really easy way to criticize crypto, because you say, well, look at that number. And we can't say, well, look at your number, because they kind of don't have one. So there is absolutely crime happening in crypto. There's far too much crime happening in crypto. But because we know the actual amount, it makes us kind of look worse than other industries where you can't put an exact amount on it.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's very true of the environmental side of stuff as well, and you know how quickly it's actually progressed for good, in terms of how new the industry is as well. Like, all of this is a pretty new thing. So yeah, that's cool. Okay, that's such an amazing sort of intro and setup of what's going on. Are there other examples of things that maybe are getting more futuristic, or as the technology moves quickly and as AI is in conversation and stuff like that, what are the kind of next level of malicious activities and examples that come to mind when you think about the future?
So there's some scary ones. So there's some that are really futuristic, and there's some that are kind of starting to happen now. So on the kind of ones that are starting to happen, one thing which you get in like virtual worlds is gated access. So you can have a token or a password that allows you into a particular building. And that's fantastic for like VIP spaces. So in Binance's HQ, for instance, in Decentraland, there's a whole area you can only get to if you have a Binance wearable. They use it very much as like a kind of customer lounge. There's a Hong Kong like medical school where you can only get in if you have a password, and in there that's for the students who are from that medical school to go in, and there's all sorts of information. They do lectures there, etc. However, what you can use that gated access for is all sorts of illicit nefarious purposes. So you can have a space, for instance, where you can only get into if you have a certain token, but in that space you could be showing videos of like child sexual abuse. You could be allowing it as a meeting place for terrorists to go and plan their next attack, and no one else can get in that space unless they have the token. So you could literally have the like metaverse police on the outside of that building, and they could not get in to see what's happening unless they have the token. And you can do voice chat in there, you can do text. You can't share files in most places yet, but that is a definite concern about these potentially like covert meeting spaces you can have in there, impenetrable in the same way that, you know, your end-to-end encrypted messages are in, say, WhatsApp, for instance. And that is a big kind of concern of law enforcement. So whilst there's, and as we can see in many cases here, there's great uses of things, there's also illicit uses that actors are thinking about. And that kind of token gated aspect is certainly a worrying one. We know that Ryuk, who were, they're like a ransomware group. So they had a pass to somewhere called Digible in Decentraland. Now that is a space that I can't get into. I don't have one of these passes, but in there is a guest book that is like a petition to free Ross Ulbricht, for instance. That's like a part of it. He was the creator of Silk Road. He's serving like a double life sentence for basically trying to getting a hitman, or several hitmen actually in the end, and also running one of the biggest drug enterprises that the internet has ever seen. There's a bit of a split community on whether he's like a kind of hero, villain, should be in prison forever, should be freed. But, you know, that is a ransomware group that has a token to get them into a building where no one else can get in that building unless you have that token. We don't know if they've used it. We don't know who they've met in there. We don't know what's in there. So, you know, there's definitely concerns there about this idea of having virtual spaces that you can only get into if you have a crypto token to get in. So that's definitely a concern from the kind of covert meeting space. There's also more kind of futuristic ones though. So thinking again about, you know, living in virtual worlds or being in them more, this concept of like 3D social engineering. So if you go into a space like, for instance, Domino's has like headquarters within there. Now, if you were particularly Dastardly, you could dress your avatar up in kind of Domino's wear. You could hang out around there. And when someone came around, you could say, hey, I'm a Domino's representative. We're running a giveaway today. If you like provide me with a bit of information, I can get you a pizza wearable, for instance. And the person's maybe a bit new to Decentraland, and they say, what do you need from me? Oh, so if you just go into your wallet, you can get a couple of like 12 words. If you give me those 12 words, I'll see if you win a raffle. Ah, that's your seed phrase. They're going to wipe everything you got. So this idea of using your avatar, making it look like someone, maybe it could be making look like your boss or a family member or a representative from a company. This idea of basically using an avatar to socially engineer people, I think we're going to start seeing more of as people become more accustomed to kind of living their lives inside the metaverse and going into virtual worlds. So that one, I think, will be an interesting one to watch. There's also this concept that I call of like wallet tainting, which is kind of like trolling for Web3. So if you think of how many people's public wallets are known, so Vitalik.eth, for instance, that's his like public Ethereum account. You know, even Justin Bieber, Jimmy Fallon, they were all very publicly tied because of buying Bored Apes to a cryptocurrency address. Now, what we'll start to see is people sending nefarious, illicit kind of content to those addresses. In the same way that, you know, if you put a picture on Instagram and then people come and write like really nasty comments, and they might like make kind of lies about you or whatever, all to try and take your reputation. What I think we're going to start seeing is effectively like Web3 trolls sending maybe like racist or homophobic NFTs to those accounts to try and taint that person's brand to say, oh, look, like X person has a load of really horrible, like maybe like racist imagery within their NFTs. I can't believe they bought that. That'll be picked up by a headline. You know, think of all sorts of drama that could cause. Now, of course, you can't stop someone sending an NFT to you if they know your address. So I think that kind of thing we'll see a lot more as people's personas online, whether it's kind of avatar based, whether it's like ENS, like, you know, Vitalik.eth based. We'll see more people trying to like take that from just being just in many ways, just like cause chaos. But then also it could be like a politician, for instance. Maybe you want to try and bring them down reputationally. So I think this idea of wallet tainting, as we have more of our lives tied on chain, will become one to watch for sure. And then at the really extreme end of kind of future crime, there was a fantastic article, fantastic but also really worrying article I read a while ago, of someone that created a VR headset with explosives in. And when you died in the game,
I saw that. Yeah,
it triggered and the headset exploded and killed you. Now, the good thing is this isn't like a commercial thing. They weren't planning to make this to sell. It's very much like a thought experiment kind of idea. But it really does, you know, pull up at the forefront some of the dangers in the tech we're going to be using, whether it's, you know, your VR headset getting hacked and the hackers getting all the data about you, about, you know, little things like the distance between your eyeballs, how you move, your height, like all of this kind of data you can get from a VR headset. That data is going to be valuable. It could be that they come in and maybe, you know, your kid's using your VR headset and they're watching a film and someone hacks it and puts in really horrible imagery. Like we saw a lot of really nasty people did by like infusing horrible imagery within like Peppa Pig YouTube videos. Like all of these kind of dangers of us using hardware much more and the potential effects of it, the potential vectors that criminals will try and think of like hacking in, that's definitely going to be a risk. You know, even thinking about things like the QR codes that we're all really used to scanning now for like menus and stuff from the pandemic. Well, I'm always really conscious about scanning them because if I was a criminal, I'd go and put a load of QR codes around in places that look legit. And then in them, I put a load of malicious code. Like, what an easy way to try and like get into someone's account. So I think that from like an augmented reality kind of hack perspective, because we'll start using augmented reality more, that means criminals will start to think about how they can use it more. So whilst, you know, all of this may come across really negative, I'm really bullish about the metaverse at large. But when I am spending a lot of time in there because of my kind of background in fighting crypto crime, I'm also sat there thinking, gosh, if I was a criminal, there's 101 ways that I would use this for nefarious purposes.
Amazingly, we've done over 40 minutes already. That's gone lightning fast, which is always a good sign. Is there any kind of final sort of general things that you tell people to look out for, some best practices? I think you've covered a lot of them in just how what you've been talking about.
So there's definitely best practices. And the good news is they're actually really simple. So the first one is like the age old, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. So crypto obviously is a place where you can flip a frog JPEG and become a millionaire, right? Like these stories can be true. But for the average person and for the majority of people, sorry to kind of burst most people's bubble here, you're not going to become a crypto millionaire by aping into a coin really early or flipping an NFT. And so when you're coming across a project which sounds like it's got amazing returns or is going to promise you the world, just take that extra moment to think for a second of, am I about to get scammed? Like, does this sound too good to be true? And in so many cases, you will go, oh, you know what? Yeah, like the chances are here, I'm probably just going to get rugged or scammed. So just taking that extra moment to ask that question of like, is this too good to be true? Because that is like the number one way that scammers will try and get you with an amazing deal. They'll try and create a lot of urgency as well. So, you know, we saw that with the Azuki one. It was like a surprise announcement. Get in first and mint your land. And all the scams that I look at, like it's a really common thread across them. They try and have this FOMO induced kind of almost like panic of like, quick, get in there and make your money. So just like take that extra time, ask yourself that question. The other thing to do, and that's really important, is verifying. So we have this term in crypto of don't trust, verify. And a lot of people, a lot of time are like, well, yeah, how do I verify? Like that statement is a bit pointless without extra info. So again, if we think of the Azuki attack, it was on a gold ticked account. So you should be thinking, oh, great, verified. double verify. So if something comes out on the project Discord, go and make sure that it's also being talked about on Twitter. If it's coming out in as a surprise announcement, especially, just double check stuff across multiple platforms for the project. If it comes out and there's like a new website has been spun up for a project, I'm always going on at least another source before I click on that to be like, is that the legit one? Because it's so easy for criminals to do. So make sure you're kind of double verifying stuff. You're taking that time to think, is this too good to be true? Because potentially, quite probably it is. And if in doubt, the best thing to do, and I actually had this today with someone, go and ask someone in the space. So I am always happy for someone to reach out and be like, is this a scam? And I've actually had this just this morning. Someone reached out on LinkedIn and said, I saw a podcast you did about staying safe in the crypto community. I've come across this website. Sounds really good. I can make a load of money, blah, blah, blah. And then gave me a little breakdown. I am probably 99% confident just reading that description, it's a scam. But I'm going to look into it for them, I'll confirm, and hopefully we'll save them a load of money. And I think not enough people do that check. And actually, even another recent example, just last week, one of my good friends from the crypto industry rang me up. I was actually on holiday at the bottom of a mountain in Chamonix. She rang me up and said, oh my God, I've got some investment for my company. It's amazing. I'm in Rome and they're like going to invest like a shed ton of money. I'm so excited. They've just asked me to move some funds into an account and just like verify it for them. And immediately I was like red alarm bell ringing because a couple of months back, the Webiverse team met an investor in Rome. They asked them to transfer some funds to an account just for proof of funds. And they'd set up the account themselves. So it wasn't like the investment company had done it. And $4 million disappeared. And as soon as this friend rang me, I was like, listen, I'm getting alarm bells here. So I said, send me more details. Look to the website. Super shady. They're like a property firm getting into crypto. So that feels a bit weird. What if they ask you to send it to? Got loads of information. I was like, listen, this is 100% a scam. Do not send this money. Heard back a couple of hours later and she was like, I've spoke to some other people. Yeah, it's the same scammers in Rome that robbed the Webiverse team, and she could have lost tens of thousands of dollars, just everything she had in crypto, to move and verify it. And luckily she rang me to check. And like, that is always the best thing to do. Like, there's a lot of us that work in crypto crime, and we work in crypto crime because we love trying to save people from crypto scams. So always take that moment to just really think, could this be a scam? Verify and verify again. And then if in doubt, and if it's any significant amount of money, reach out to someone in the crime space so that we can do a bit of extra due diligence and just make sure.
Yeah, yeah, that is well said for sure. And I'm glad that she didn't send the money. That's important. But yeah, I've said fascinating about 100 times on this episode, but thank you so much because that has been amazing and so interesting. I know people are going to really love listening to that. Definitely shout out where people can follow you to keep up to date with everything because it moves so fast. You write amazing content as well. I read a really good article you posted about the Bitcoin Lightning Network, which helped me understand it loads. So where can people go to follow you and keep up to date with what you're doing?
So LinkedIn is definitely the best place. So on Mondays, I write about kind of technical things in crypto explained for the non-technical person. Then on Wednesdays, I write all about the metaverse. And then Friday is all about crypto crime. So more content than I think anyone would ever want. But there's so much going on in the space. As you say, there's so much to write about. So yeah, LinkedIn is definitely the best place.
Awesome. I will leave it in the description. But yeah, Tara, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.